So good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up later this hour, we'll focus on President Biden's climate plans. He has a series of executive orders. We'll talk about what the potential effect would be on CO2 emissions, as well as on various American industries. And we'll take a look at whether the president's moves are going as far as some environmentalists would like to see, or if they're not necessarily using the best possible trade-offs, as some critics might say. So we'll talk about that coming up. But first, we're pleased to be joined by Los Angeles County District Attorney George Gascón, who was elected last November as a reformer of the DA department. And of course, Los Angeles County and its criminal justice system so massive that any reforms enacted here potentially have a significant national effect as well. Mr. Gascón, thank you so much. Great to have you with us again on Air Talk.
My pleasure, Larry. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well, thanks. Let's start first of all with, some folks would say this has been kind of a rocky start because as you quickly implemented a number of policy changes with the department, your prosecutor's union has filed a lawsuit against you. You've had judges who have refused to dismiss sentencing enhancements in cases and have been critical of that move. You've had other district attorneys such as San Diego, Sacramento, Fresno, who have said they may well not jointly work on prosecutions with you because of your dropping the sentencing enhancements. What do you make of the criticism and the pushback you're receiving?
Look, we're moving a massive system that has been deeply embedded in mass incarceration and punishment for generations, but especially in the last 40 years. And the district attorneys that you're mentioning, these are people that have been very much part of the mass incarceration era. These are people that had campaigned very aggressively against every criminal justice reform in the last 8 or 9 years. In fact, Proposition 20, which was an attempt to unwind a lot of the criminal justice reforms of the last decade, was sponsored by these people, and it lost by about 60%. There is no question that moving away from a system that has been deeply embedded in incarceration has created, political and monetary incentives for people. It's hard for people to move on. While I'm not going to talk in the specifics of the lawsuit by the association, suffice to say that they did not take a vote. It was something that the executive board did on their own. This is the same executive board that put hundreds of thousands of dollars in a campaign against me, and they're basically trying to relitigate the election. But, we're moving forward. There's a lot of support both internally and externally. In fact, as a result of this lawsuit, there were 65 attorney generals and district attorneys and former district attorneys, including two previous LA district attorneys. They have provided, friends of the court briefings to support my position in this particular case.
Let's go back, though, to what's actually claimed in the DA Association lawsuit against you, is that you're going beyond what the law allows you to do. They claim, is when it comes to three strikes, that yes, the district attorney's office has latitude, but it's on a case-by-case basis, that you can't just legally, unilaterally decide, no, we're not going to, in these specific cases, prosecute these under second or third strike provisions. So their claim is that what you're saying is the office won't follow the law. Your response to that?
Yeah, I disagree. Obviously, we are going to argue this in court, and we have constitutional experts that have joined in this process because they disagree. The reality is that the elected district attorney has a wide level of discretion, and what these prosecutors are alleging is contrary to that discretion. In fact, it's interesting that they and every prosecutor uses this discretion as they see fit, but in this particular case, they believe that because it doesn't follow the policies that they're supporting, that somehow this is less legal than when you do it individually. I disagree, but again, it's an area that we're going to let the courts decide. But let me just say for the audience that we have some of the top constitutional experts in the field that wholeheartedly disagree with the association's position in this case, and we'll let the court take its process.
We're talking with Los Angeles County District Attorney George Gascón with us on Air Talk. Mr. Gascón, the prosecutors also claim that when you take away the using a gun in the commission of a crime enhancement or gang enhancement, other ones that are available, that takes a very practical form of leverage in plea deals out of their hands. So their argument is one that under the law, you can only on a case-by-case basis decide you're not going to pursue specific enhancements. And secondly, that if you do this as a blanket office policy, you take away the deputy DA's ability to negotiate an appropriate sentence. Your response to that claim?
Yeah, and that's precisely one of the major drivers of mass incarceration in this country has been the overcharging by prosecutors and basically forcing sometimes people to either plead guilty to something that they may not have been or accept incredibly larger sentences in order to avoid the potential of a risk of a trial. The law as it is, without the enhancements, we have what is called a triad, where for every offense, there is a low, a mid, and a top level range of sentencing. And that is the parameters upon which we should be able to operate. And using enhancements in order to coerce a different outcome, I actually find it to be unethical, and there's no question, and there's studies after studies that show that one of the major drivers of mass incarceration is the overcharging by prosecutors using these enhancements. So they are right that I am taking a tool away from them in order to coerce people into accepting perhaps more severe punishment. Also, what they are doing is we continue to enhance a system that creates high levels of recidivism. About 70% of the people that we touch recidivate, which creates a trail of victims for years to come. And about 95% of the people that we incarcerate are going to come back out. So what we're doing is we are creating future victims in a system that continues to fail over and over again. And part of that is that leverage that prosecutors are so accustomed to dealing with, which create this incestuous environment where people are, they're overly prosecuted. We overcharge the cases, and we do so with almost impunity. And that creates a great level of insecurity as more people reoffend in the future.
You made the point that you think longer sentences actually increase recidivism, and I don't know what studies you're citing in that, but as a practical matter, if you have, most crime, particularly violent crime, is committed by younger people. And so if you have, let's say, a 20-year sentence for a highly violent crime versus, let's say, a 30-plus-year sentence, would you not have less recidivism under the longer sentence? Because we know age is related to violence. So the older someone gets out, the less likely they would be to commit a violent crime than someone, say, who goes in at, 27 and comes out at 47.
Well, look, I mean, certainly if we hold somebody in prison until they're in their 70s or 80s, the likelihood that they're going to reoffend lessens, tremendously. But the problem is that there is also an interim cycle here where we send people to prison for cycles of 8, 10, 15, 20 years, and they come back out. They're still very young. They are now, frankly, they're very traumatized by the prison system. And there are studies, including studies that were done in Houston and other places, they have shown that there is a correlation for every year of additional incarceration. There is somewhere between a 4 and a 7% increase in the likelihood that a person is going to recidivate. So the question is, you know, there is a path, there is a journey before people get sent to prison for the 30, 40 years. And it usually is on the 5, 6, 8, 10 year, you know, times. And those people continue to reoffend. Number one. Number two, you take a 17 year old and you send them to prison for 20 or 30 years. They're still coming out. They still are, you know, potentially very violent and very able to reoffend again. So moving away from a system that is based on no data and a system that is based on, you know, heavily on punishment and emotion, and into a system that uses data and science to provide the right levels of intervention so we reduce recidivism, we create higher levels of community wellness, is the direction that we should be going. And, you know, it's really interesting because often people talk about, you know, show me the data or the science, which is plenty to show that reform works. But nobody has ever asked for data or science to show that what we have been doing has been failing miserably. And that's why we have such a large levels of insecurity. That's why our recidivism rate is so high, nearly 70%.
And yet crime has gone down overall, though. We've seen dramatic decreases in the crime rate at the same time that the prison population increased. So isn't that part of the argument that people have made here? If you're going to dramatically decrease the prison population, crime will likely go up as a result.
But here's actually, and I disagree with you in part. We had a decrease in crime in the early 80s and 90s, and then we sort of hit a plateau. Since 2011, California has engaged in major decarceration. We went from nearly 170,000, 180,000 people in state prison to 120,000. We lower our sentencing. Our crime actually continued to go down. So I would argue that the most recent historical patterns in the last 8 or 9 years has been significant incarceration and significant reductions in crime. So the history, especially the more recent history, is one that speaks to the incarceration actually continues to make us safer. Interestingly enough, LA County, not counting 2020, had a 25% increase in violent crime in the last 7 years. And yet LA County incarcerated, their prison commitment rates were higher than 70% of all the other counties in the state. In fact, there were four times the rate of San Francisco, where we had actually a decrease in violent crime during the same period of time per capita, and we had a 25% increase in LA County. So actually, LA County actually very specifically proves the point that I'm making, that over-incarceration does not make us safer. The reverse is the case.
We're talking with the District Attorney of Los Angeles County, George Gascón, with us on Air Talk today. He's just a couple of months into his tenure, leading what is one of the world's largest prosecutorial agencies. And you can share questions with him on our Air Talk page. You can tweet at Air Talk. You can post on the Air Talk page at kpecc.org. I also wanted to ask you about the 20,000 state prison inmates that you're supporting the early release of those. When do you expect that program? This has to do with, you know, looking at people who were sentenced with those enhancements that you think were detrimental to justice. How long is it going to take for those 20,000 to be released?
Well, I mean, look, this is a matter of state law, right? Under state law, there are somewhere between 20 and 30,000 people that were committed to prison in LA County in the last 3-4 decades that may qualify to be released. Now, part of the process is that actually the state correction system and the parole boards, they have to actually deem the individual eligible to be released. And then in many cases, they have to come back to the original court of jurisdiction for resentencing. So the court will have a review of that. So there are multiple steps here. What we are saying and what I am saying is that those people that qualify to have their terms reviewed under the law, they deserve to have that review, which will include a determination by the State Department of Corrections and the court of original jurisdiction agreeing to that release. this is potentially multi-billion dollars in savings to the state, releasing people that the system, including CDCR, has determined that they are have been rehabilitated and they are no longer a threat to public safety. But again, it's not just simply me saying let's release everybody. It's opening up the review process and allowing the system under the law to take a look at these cases and where it is appropriate to have people released back into the community.
Are you concerned that, at least in some of those cases, they were sentenced under gang enhancements, those individuals then come back into the communities where they were before, and that this could lead to a resurgence in gang activity in Los Angeles County?
Not necessarily, because again, there are multiple filters that this process will go through to evaluate where the person is today. I think that the problem is when we look at somebody's original commitment decades ago, and we're looking at where they are today, and we basically make a blanket statement that this person continues to be as dangerous as they were 20 or 30 years ago, is sort of, you know, completely ignoring the reality that human beings evolve, that we all change. I know that I am not the same person that I was 20 or 30 years ago. I suspect, Larry, that you are not either. Maturity, there are many things that kick into process. And there is a very, very arduous review process for this. But I think that for us to continue to say that somebody that was dangerous 20 or 30 years ago continues to be dangerous today without any review is like almost negating the possibility of redemption and rehabilitation. And that is very problematic. And that precisely has been the kind of thinking that has taken our country to be the largest incarcerator in the world. And, you know, we were not always that way. You know, before the period of mass incarceration in the early 1980s, we were on par with the rest of most of the industrialized democracies in the world. We had a prison population of somewhere in the mid 20,000. And by 1990, we had creeped up to almost 100,000. And then three strikes came in 1994. And by 1999, we were at 160,000, 170,000 people in prison. We became completely an outlier. We led the nation in the spirit of mass incarceration. And it got to the point there was an early return on investment. And then that return started to diminish to the point where for the last 7 or 8 years, actually since 2011, we have shown that you can actually decarcerate safely and crime will continue to go down. What? And frankly, there's little correlation between lengthy incarcerations and safety. There is a lot of data that shows that. There's very little science behind the concept that incarcerating people over extended periods of time is always going to make us safer.
We're going to continue with George Gascon. He is the Los Angeles County District Attorney. We have some news in that I'm sure is going to be very difficult to hear for fans of the Saved by the Bell television series. Dustin Diamond, who played the role of Screech on that television series, died today at the age of 44 after a three-week fight with carcinoma, according to his representative. Dustin Diamond, who played Screech on the very popular teen and childhood show Saved by the Bell, dying today at the age of 44. We have more with George Gascon coming up right here on Air Talk in just 1 minute. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're joined by District Attorney for Los Angeles County, George Gascon. Kathy writes on our Air Talk page, "The community of victims of violent crime do not support your new policies, which have trampled over victims' constitutional and Marcy's law rights. You've not recognized or respected their right to be heard. Your policies are forcing victims to take time off from their jobs, to attend court during a global pandemic, to ask the judge to follow the law, not your policies." George Gascon, your response to what Kathy is posting.
Yeah, look, I mean, first of all, the statement is one that actually fails to recognize that the community of survivors and victims is not homogeneous, and that many people actually want to see rehabilitation and redemption, number one. Number two, you know, as a district attorney, as the elected district attorney, I am the people's lawyer for everyone. Not only do I represent today's victims, but I also represent future victims, and I represent the community at large. And it's really important that we strike a balance in addressing the needs sometimes for, you know, the desire for retribution of a victim today, but also that we balance that with the needs of our community and the capacity to deal with victimization in the future. Recidivism implies that there are many victims in the future that get harmed because of bad policies today. Number one. Number two, one of the things that we are doing and we're starting in this path is that we're creating a different way of approaching our victim services through science and trauma-informed care. We will stand with the victim. We will support the victim in their need to deal with their trauma. They are definitely getting their MARCY rights protected. They get notified. We have our victim services representative then with them. But we have to strike a very careful balance in not harming our community or future generations of our community and victims by simply narrowly focusing on the desires of a person today. That is not the role of the district attorney. As a district attorney, we're the people's lawyer. We're the lawyer for an entire community, which includes the victim today, but also victims of the future.
Let me ask you about, because you mentioned about rehabilitation, and obviously we hear these very affirming and terrific stories of people who in prison really rehabilitated themselves, either through self-study or transformative experiences, and come out as dramatically changed individuals. But we also hear that there's not a lot going on institutionally to work with inmates on rehabilitating and, you know, getting vocational training or social skill training, the kinds of things that are going to help them be able to have control of their lives when they come out. So when you talk about people coming out and being rehabilitated, except for the people who just through sheer force of will and ability can do it themselves, are people being rehabilitated?
And, you know, it's a question that we as a society have to ask ourselves, right? Most industrialized democracies put a great deal of effort to ensure that the time that people are going to spend in incarceration is being spent productively in order to facilitate their reintegration into society. Approximately 40 years ago, we sort of moved away from that concept in our prison system, and that's why our recidivism rate is so high. Part of that problem, though, has been over-incarceration. We have saturated the system to a point that is unable to do the work of rehabilitation well. So what I am trying to do, and what many people in my place are trying to do around the country, is to say, look, we need to start to unwind the process. We need to provide a release valve so that our prison systems can get back into the rehabilitation system. We have to right-size the system, which entails that people that are already deemed to be nonviolent, non-serious, that are low risk for the system, meaning the prison system has come to the conclusion that this person is safe to be released, they need to be released. We cannot continue to punish people forever, even when all the indications of the people that know best, which is the people on the parole boards and the people in the prison system, are saying, this person is not the same person that he or she was 2, 3, 4 decades ago, and therefore they should be released, so which will create then the capacity to provide for training and rehabilitation for a smaller population and the funding to do so.
All right. So you think there are enough people who've, even in these circumstances, been able to do it. It's safe to let them out. But I want to close with, you know, some of the sharp criticism of your management style, not just your policies. You didn't consult with leading prosecutors in your office before implementing the new policies right out of the gate. You didn't consult with members of the judiciary or law enforcement leaders. Rank and file prosecutors have been critical that they say you haven't reached out much to them. So what is your response to this critique that you've not been collaborative in leading your office?
Look, you know, my whole election was about collaboration, right? Over 2 million people in LA County voted for a very clear agenda. And I made very clear during the election process that my promises were a contract with the community. And the day one that I got elected, I went about fulfilling that contract with the community, which, by the way, there are many people inside the office that support, and clearly there are some that do not. You know, the District Attorney's Association put a lot of money to run a campaign against me. They lost their race, and they are trying to relitigate the election. The reality is that it was very transparent from day one. I work for the people. And during the election process, I laid out a plan of the things that we were going to do. And that was contrary to what a lot of folks in law enforcement, you know, there was about over $7 million in money that was spent by law enforcement unions to support my opponent. They lost. And they're still having a hard time coming to grips with the fact that they lost, and they lost by a wide margin. I announced on my first day in office the things that I promised that I was going to do. That's not an issue of not being collaborative. To the contrary, I was extremely collaborative. I work with the voters of LA County who put me in office, and that was the promise, and that is what I'm doing now.
Mr. Gascon, thank you for being with us. I sure look forward to talking with you again in the next few weeks to get an update on what's happening with your office, with the potential release of those that are in state custody who are rehabilitated, and more news from the DA's office. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Larry. Look forward to talking to you. Take care.
I appreciate it. George Gascon, Los Angeles County District Attorney, joining us on Air Talk on KPCC, and so glad that he's agreed to join us on a regular basis to talk about these issues because, as I said at the outset, Los Angeles County has really become the focus of criminal justice reform measures for the rest of the United States. And so what George Gascon is doing here isn't just being watched locally, it is being watched on a national basis. In fact, the Heritage Society, the conservative think tank, just came out with a huge paper taking great issue with George Gascon being highly critical of the policies that he's enacted. He's raised plenty of attention. With us to talk about that broader context is KPCC criminal justice correspondent Frank Stoltz. Frank, so good to have you with us.
Hey, Larry.
So your thoughts about what we heard from the DA today, and seemed to me pretty consistent from the line that he took when we talked with him a few weeks ago.
I agree. And it's pretty extraordinary what he's talking about. Really a revolution in criminal justice in Los Angeles that, as you've described, has drawn fire, not just from some of his own prosecutors, judges, fellow district attorneys in the state, but also national conservatives who really now see him as a lightning rod for liberal criminal justice policies. And so the showdown is here, Larry. This is ground zero.
Frank, you know, it's interesting, the collaboration question that I asked him at the end, and it's, you know, to paraphrase, essentially saying, look, I took everybody's input. I ran as a reformer. I said clearly what I was going to do. I'm doing that now. So I'm not going to go back to the people who campaigned against me, raised money to fight the reforms, and ask them, what do you think about this, essentially? But, you know, one of the challenges for him, of course, is he is getting these headwinds in multiple areas.
Well, and I describe them as liberal criminal justice policies. You know, what he says he's doing, as he described, is really trying to make the justice system more just. You know, one of the most disturbing statistics in criminal justice is that Black folks, overwhelmingly men, comprise nearly one third of the people in state prisons and jails, even though they make up just 6.5% of the state's population. And this is really driven, according to Gascon, by these gang and gun enhancements, by the three strikes law, by this drive over the past three or four decades, you know, to lock people up longer and longer. And so he he's not just seeking to address mass incarceration, but to address these racial disparities.
KPCC criminal justice correspondent Frank Stoltz joining us on Air Talk after our conversation with George Gascon. Frank, what is the status of this lawsuit that the Union of the Deputy DAs has filed?
Well, it's a hearing tomorrow. Initially, the judge did not grant the prosecutor's union's request for a temporary restraining order, which would have stopped some of Gascon's policies, including the removal of these sentencing enhancements, like the gun enhancements and gang enhancements, and the three strikes enhancement. And tomorrow, we may very well get a ruling from the judge on whether or not the prosecutor's union will be able to block, in part, some of the new DA's efforts. Some of this opposition by prosecutors is, based on their idea that people should be locked up longer. And some of it also is they've gotten very comfortable with these enhancements, which have given them, a huge advantage in plea negotiations. I think Gascon talked about this too. Plea negotiations, with defendants, where they're hanging over, this 20-year sentence. And so, of course, they're going to take, something that's 10 years rather than risk the 20 years of trial.
He described it as unethical, Frank.
He did. He did. And there are plenty of people that describe this as unethical. But the system has gotten very comfortable with these enhancements and these long prison terms. And even I would argue, the public is comfortable with, longer prison terms. But when you think about it, 10 years for instance, an armed robbery is quite a long time. Is it the right amount of time? And we haven't really gotten to that discussion. There are a lot of numbers that fly around in plea deals and in charging and, but what is the appropriate amount of time and how could the system work better? Because he correctly argues that there are studies that show, that at some point, I think it's 6 or 7 years, the longer the term, it's basically having, a negative effect, diminishing returns.
Frank, thanks so much. Before I let you go, just anything else to briefly add about what you heard from the DA?
I think that he is in for a fight. He's got some of his prosecutors, judges, the fellow DAs, the National Heritage Foundation, as you said. So tonight, Larry, he's holding a public conversation. He and a group called the Los Angeles District Attorney Accountability Coalition that supports him. They're holding a support meeting tonight, basically an organizing meeting. So he's having to organize politically just to defend himself right now.
Frank, thanks so much. And as always, we'll look forward to your continuing coverage of this. And we're also putting out a request to the Prosecutors Association to join us and talk about their perspective on the lawsuit they filed against the new District Attorney of Los Angeles County, George Gascon. That's Frank Stoltz, KPCC and LAist. Criminal justice correspondent. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, we'll take a look at President Biden's executive orders. There are a number of them dealing with environmental concerns, particularly related to global warming. We'll talk about what benefits are expected, what the trade-offs are economically. We'll get into that in just 90 seconds.